Avalanche City. You may have heard of the band, as they sat atop of the New Zealand music charts a few years ago. And the reason that I bring that up is because today I'm joined by the one and only Johnny Brock, the former bass player of Avalanche City, and now doing his own thing, Johnny Brock, on Spotify to check out his tunes. Oh, and more impressively, he's a former colleague of mine. In this pod, we chat about the highs of topping the music charts, to the lows that can happen when it's suddenly taken away, some of the mental and physical tolls that can take, some of the unseen costs, some of the learns, and we also touch on the transition back to a comparatively regular life afterwards. Let's get started. Johnny Brock, ladies and gentlemen. I have to say, it's an absolute honour to have a genuine superstar on the podcast. It's also good to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. How are we, and pals?
There we go.
Yeah.
How are we, sir?
I'm really well, thank you. I'm good. I've been looking forward to this for a few weeks now, and it is great to be here and have the full experience.
It is a full experience because we did coffee, walk, and you threw in a left field addition to that as well.
We did.
Where did you take me?
We stopped at the West Cornwall Pasty Company for a spicy beef pasty. Because when the opportunity arises, one must make the most of the opportunity.
I said superstar in the intro to this because you are a music sensation. You reached the top of the New Zealand charts.
Once upon a time, yeah. We can talk about that. So,
fire in.
Music has always been my thing. I like music. My dad was a musician. I grew up around music. I also grew up in the church, so my parents were like ran a church for when I was growing up.
Were you in the choir?
No. So like, think less like Anglican, Catholic, traditional, and think more like modern Pentecostal, evangelical style.
Okay.
And we get somewhere.
What like carols do you sing?
Yeah, so we didn't do carols, we didn't do hymns. It's much more like, yeah, it's much more like popular culture twist on like music. So growing up, I was always like playing in a church band and doing things like that. So a lot of GC&D, and then you do the like Christmas Carol Sunday, but that was kind of part of it. So
what's your favorite Christmas carol?
I really like the one, Oh Holy Night. I like that. I like that a lot. My favorite Christmas song is actually not a carol. It's the theme to Home Alone, Somewhere in My Memory. That's a great tune.
How does that one go again?
We're going to leave it there.
Okay.
So we don't get into like copyright issues.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, true. Yeah.
But that has a choir in it, which is good. And so growing up, music was my thing, and that's what I wanted to do. And I started playing in bands when I was like 12 years old. And they were my first band. There were three guitar players and one drummer. And we didn't have a singer because we were all 12. And the drummer was 9 years old, and he was way better than the rest of us. Wow. So all of our songs were pretty much just drums.
Were you not competing with the other two guitarists for attention?
Oh, 100%. That's how that works. Like in bands, everybody just wants to be the guitar player. Which is why now I'm always the bass player, because everybody needs one of those. I did music through high school, and then I went to university and was doing a songwriting degree because I decided to give the whole like backup plan thing a bit of a miss. I had originally gone to university to study a history degree because I thought and was told that backup plans were good if you wanted to do like creative endeavors, and both my parents were teachers, and so the only world I could really envisage for myself or was familiar with at that time was like teaching. So I was like, I don't want to be a music teacher because that's like too close to what you're into. But like, I liked the history teacher in my high school, and I was like, I could do that.
You see, from starting a band from 12 and going, and then I assume you didn't go to uni at 12, but from when you then went to uni, so like the teenage years, what were you talking, like, what was that like?
Were we performing anywhere? Yeah, so we had like a different band every year, pretty much. And so like, by the time you hit like 18, you've gone through a few bands at that point.
Kind of like the Sugar Babes.
Exactly. We had a revolving lineup. And
were you the one constant?
No. So, like, bands live and die all the time. So you're like, hey, let's hang out. We should start a band. And then you're in a band. That's kind of how that works. Okay. All you need to be in a band is a name. You don't even need a photo.
We're going to create a band after this.
We can do that, yeah.
Come on.
And we can, like, we had some really great names. So, we're not going to go into this, but every band has a terrible name. That's just the thing with bands and names.
It's like first email addresses.
Yeah, which is one of my favorite questions as like get to know someone as an icebreaker. It's like, what was the first email address you chose for yourself?
Mate, that is going to now become the name question for this podcast.
So mine was iamdribble @hotmail.com.
You are dribble?
Dribble, yeah.
Dribble.
I am dribble.
Football dribble? Or like dribbling?
Yeah. More like dribbling. But there was a... I was like 12 or 13 and I was like, I'm going to get an email address because that seemed like a thing you should do.
Yeah.
And then you're posed with the page where it's like, well, enter the email address you want. And I was like, well, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. And your name's gone and everything else is gone. And I hadn't kind of figured out underscores yet. So that wasn't going to happen.
Okay.
And on the TV was a PlayStation ad. And it was this werewolf. It was for the PlayStation 2 at the time. And the script was, I am teeth, I am fur, I am dribble, I am the wolf man, and I punch the sun. And so I was like, well, I am dribble.
@hotmail.com.
@hotmail.com. Yeah, exactly. I should have gone for like sun puncher or something like way cooler. But that's what we did.
I still use my first email address. It's my Facebook login.
Yeah.
It's badass_birchy2001@hotmail.com.
I'm into that. And if you want to send fan mail, send that there.
Yeah.
Zuckerberg's going to love that.
Bands. Sorry.
So you start off playing like school things and like, it's like music performances. You like have to play in front of like your classmates or like to get graded or whatever. And then we'd play at like school assemblies. And then sometimes we'd like, set up like a sound system in like the quad or like the school gym and then like do a little lunchtime performance and that sort of stuff. And then that kind of like escalated to like band competitions that people would put on kind of like for like youth events and things like that. And then we made some friends with some local musicians, I guess through church and church connections. And we started playing in pubs when we were like 17 or like 16. And so like our parents would have to like come to like get us in the door. And then
it was proper rock and roll.
Yeah, and my granddad came one time and he said it sounded like going to the Panel Beaters. That was his like official review of the band.
The what?
Like going to the Panel Beaters, like the body shop for your car, like getting dents banged out of the doors.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that was officially like, that's what we did. And then in parallel to that was this church thing. So we'd be playing like church services on Sundays and then like music rehearsals during the week. And the thing with church bands is that it's always like a bit of a... like a rotating roster, right? It's like volunteers, who's up for it, who's available, who's around. And you don't want to like take up too much people's time, but they need to be in it enough that like they're up with the repertoire and all that sort of jazz. So you're kind of like playing with different people and different ages and different abilities. And there's this wonderful thing where it's like playing music is great and lots of people do it and lots of people should do it. And you don't have to be a professional standard to be able to like partake in that. And so it meant that you were always like, when I started, I was the worst person in the band. By the time I finished, I was one of the better people in the band. And you kind of like learn off different people and you rub against different people in nice ways. Rubbing against people in nice ways
illegal,
in the church.
Yeah. Fully.
Exactly.
Consensual ways.
Exactly. And then I went to university to do...
more rubbing.
To do my music degree, yeah. And... I had a friend's band who I was living with, and they were this like really cool indie folk outfit, and they used to rehearse in my bedroom. And so I'd leave and they would like turn up and use my space for their band practice. And then they wanted to record a song, so they got this like local engineer on board and they went to his house and recorded the song at their house. And they didn't have a bass player for the song, and I was a bass player at university. And so... they asked if I'd come and play along. So I met this guy and I sat in his house and they played me the song and I did it once and I'd never heard the song before and I was like, okay, that's how the song goes. Second time, laid it down, that was it. Went home, game over. Couple of months later, this guy gets back in touch with me, the sound engineer, and he's like, I'm starting to perform and I write songs as well. And he was a jingle writer by trade. And so he wrote these really catchy pop songs and he's like, I really liked you coming in and you did a great job and would you play bass with me in this thing. And I was like, yeah, okay. So that's how I met this guy, Dave. And at the time, it was Dave and Dave's best friend, Ben, who was a drummer, and myself. And we would go around to his house on Tuesday nights in Mount Eden after university. And we'd like set up and we'd jam as a three piece. And eventually we like brought more people on board and more people on board until there were like six of us. And so we had like a violin player and we had a drummer and we had electric guitars and keyboards and he sang and I played bass. And during that time, he was a recording engineer. So he'd write these pop jingles and he'd record bands and that was kind of his thing. And so he would write these songs and record them and he went away and came back with this album that he'd made. And essentially we became the band that would perform this album. And because he was a jingle writer, he had a really good pop hook and he writes good songs. And I think the right place at the right time. Mm. And we were very much on like the indie folk pop wave, right? When like Mumford & Sons was a big thing over here. So we're talking like 2010, 2011. Yeah. And the song that he put out called Love, 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 was a bit of an earworm and people just really liked it. And I remember the first time he ever performed that song because it was at this like local folk night that we were playing at. And I hadn't, maybe he'd met him at that point, maybe not. And he's like, I wrote the song today. And he played it off a piece of paper in front of him. And he forgot the words halfway through and forgot how it went. And was like, oh, I'll finish that later. And just like, that was the start of the song. And then that song got picked up by like a national TV station as their ident song. So every commercial break, going into the ads or out of the ads, you'd hear this little hook of his song. And then people would call the radio stations and go, well, I want the TV2 song. And so that song went crazy. And he did a really clever thing at the time where he gave the album away for free. So he had a web page and he just chucked it up there and was like, it was around the time of like Radiohead and Rainbows. It was like, pay what you want was new and novel and people talked about it. And so he put this album out and he recorded himself and he did a great job of it. And it still holds up. It's a great sounding record for free. And so people had it, it was on TV, it was everywhere. He got paid a little bit of cash for the TV thing, but not loads, but the exposure was massive. And so it blew up and went to number one in New Zealand.
This is huge. So the song is called Love, Love, Love.
Yeah.
And the band?
It was called Avalanche City.
Did you have anything to do with the naming?
No, so that was pre-made and that was done. And I didn't write the songs and I didn't play on the album, but I did play in the live band that promoted that. And so what happened is, you can imagine, is we started getting label attention because the song kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I remember once we had a few labels who were kind of interested. And so we would invite them to see us play and we didn't have a massive schedule and we didn't have a lot of shows. So we had the guys from Sony in Australia fly out to see us. And the only gig in the timetable was at a youth group, like a Christian youth group, in like the middle of nowhere. And so these like label execs would turn up in their suits and like come and sit through a church service, and then at the end of the church service we'd play like 10 minutes, and it was like crazy, and it was like a church setup, so like the drummer was in a different room to everyone else, and like, because you want to keep drum sounds quiet for the congregation, so these big perspex screens, and like it was awful and it was really bad, and they still wanted to sign us afterwards. And so we didn't sign with them. He ended up signing with Warners. Okay. And at the time, Warners Australia, and at the time, it was the biggest record deal in Australasia, or maybe for a New Zealand band, up until that point, on paper. And then, like, Lord came out a couple of years later, and, like, Kimbra came out, and I absolutely smashed those. But at the time, it was, like, a big deal. So we signed to Warners in Australia, or Dave signed to Warners in Australia.
And before that, were you, in terms of, like, touring, gigging, is Christian Church as big as it got?
No, so that was kind of like a bit of a weird like one-off, and I don't even know how that happened. I think at that point, like, we were just keen to play.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of fun together, and like we sounded good, and we enjoyed hanging out, and it was always like quite fun. And so we...
Because you must have been surely higher demand if you were top of the charts.
Yeah, and we got like a manager, and then we started playing like better gigs. And we did like New Zealand tours, and the whole thing with like album cycles with when labels get involved is like the first couple of years you don't expect to make any money because you're just like out on the road playing loads of shows, no one's getting paid. And so we were touring New Zealand, and It would be that classic thing where you'd play for like 50 minutes and the crowd would know 3 minutes of that.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it, you're kind of trying to convince people to stay for the big song at the end. And we did a couple of like music festivals and things like that. And then at the same time, we were trying to kind of crack Australia. So we were touring Australia a lot. But it was one of those things where it was like, we didn't have any money. There was no really guarantees that anything was going to happen. It was just kind of like, see what happens and go out and do it and meet people and play shows and see what happens. And so we were touring Australia, staying in youth hostels. And I remember one youth hostel that we stayed in, we'd like turn up and dump our stuff. And like, it was literally like a room of bunks.
Yeah.
And the whole band is in one room of bunks with no bedding. And the pillows were made out of plastic. And if you wanted a towel, it was $10. Like, and the windows didn't open. And it was like 35 degrees outside.
God, the glamour of being top of the charts.
Yeah, exactly. And we'd pile into a van and drive to the next place. Or you'd fly to the next place. And I just remember, like, I didn't have a smartphone then. But a couple of the other people in the band did. So I remember being like, hey, man, can I borrow your phone to play, like, Flappy Bird? Or like log into my
that
Facebook.
That was solid, that game.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Like it was kind of this weird thing where you just like find yourself in airports for hours and hours with nothing to do except like share one smartphone between like six people. Like, you're crazy.
What was the kind of duration of this touring thing? How much of your life did it take up?
It was a couple of years. So it was kind of like 2010, we kind of like started doing it. 2011 was big. And then the start of 2012, we did this tour called the Winery Tour, which happens every year in New Zealand. And it's like, it's the biggest tour. It's the biggest money-making tour for New Zealand bands anyway. And we played 24 vineyards around the country in 3 or 4 weeks.
Nice.
And so we were the opening band on a bill of with two other artists, and we all had big tour support. And like, I had a guy whose job it was to like tune my bass for me, so I didn't have to go to sound check. We literally would turn up 10 minutes before, you walk on stage, everything's exactly how you left it the night before in a different city. And all the vineyards were trying to like outdo each other with hospitality. So it was just like the green rooms were like next level, and half the band didn't drink. And so we were just collecting bottles of wine all around the country, and we had to buy extra luggage to like fit them in. And then at the last stop,
So this is like, now we're talking, right? This
yeah, yeah.
Is
like, and that was like,
here we go.
Yeah, and that was
this
cool.
Is less bunk beds and more like,
yeah, we were staying in hotels, and we had like a tour manager, and we like were doing that sort of stuff. And it was really great. But at that point, like, I think relationships were quite frayed. We'd been doing like the same set for like 2 years.
By doing that, do you feel like you start to get maybe complacent, bored with doing the same thing? Or did you see it as like, no, this is good, getting the reps in and we're getting better each time?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Like, so, how did you feel about it, I suppose, at the time?
Yeah, so I'm a perfectionist, 100%. So my goal for me going into that tour was 24 shows and I want to nail every single one of those.
Yeah.
And to that point of like, at that point, it's less a creative endeavor and more just like get the reps in, nail it. Make it work.
Yeah.
And I did
20... It's almost embrace the boredom.
Because... The repetition of it, yeah, 100%. And
yeah, not the boredom, but yeah.
Yeah, and I did 24 shows in a row and didn't play a bung note once.
Boom.
Yeah, so I was like, yeah, cool, I can do that. And... Yeah, and I think being someone who plays a few different instruments, so I'm like a guitarist first, and then I was playing bass... And bass is sometimes like seen as like really simplified version of guitar and things. And so I try to embrace that, like every note I play or every note I don't play, trying to be like really intentional with that. So it's not like, are you playing the right note, but are you playing the right note with the right energy and the right vibe? And are you contributing to something bigger than just that little part of it? And so I get really into it. And I think it is one of those things where it's like you can find pride in the little things if you're wired for that kind of like attention to detail. And yeah. So I didn't mind that. But at the end of that, it was kind of like, we weren't really sure what was going to happen after that. And we, at that point, we'd like had a different song on like Grey's Anatomy in the States.
Oh, yes.
And we had like the Love, Love, Love song got picked up as like a film promo for like a Jack Nicholson and Helen Mirren film, and like all these little things were like popping off where you're like, yeah, my mum's gonna be so proud of this. I remember once I went out to a cafe with my parents and the waiter came and served us, and my dad was like, do you know who this is? And I was like, oh god, I wish I was dead. But
well, I tried that at the pasty shop earlier. Well, yeah, it didn't work.
Exactly. And I guess it's that thing where it's like, people are sweet, and I guess it was his way of showing me that he that he was proud of me, even if it was in like a way that maybe wasn't your favorite at the time. And so 2012 was looking like it was going to be a big year. We got told essentially, clear your schedules, we're going to be doing like a big international push. And we'd done some showcase gigs in the States at that point, in Japan. We opened for like the Katie Tunstall tour over there. I didn't play that tour because it was like a smaller stripped down kind of version of the band, and sometimes the band would play just him, and sometimes it would play with six of us, and sometimes it would be two or three people kind of going around. But we'd done like, I did a shift in West Hollywood where we went and played to like a bunch of music people out there. We did, the band had done like New York and London, and it was kind of like 2012 was shaping up to be the year, really, like clear schedules, be available, we're going to do this thing.
So did you feel, so I suppose a couple of things, because you kind of almost got this success and exposure young, early, through like, almost, it seems like it kind of came quite easily to you. Did that set your expectation that like, God, this whole life thing, this is...
Yeah, it was a funny one, because music was something that I always wanted, and what I always saw myself doing. And I knew that it wasn't always going to be easy, but I was stupid enough, maybe naive enough, or young enough to be like, yeah, let's do this and we'll make this work. And it doesn't work for everyone. Sure, I totally get that, but I'll make it work for me.
Yeah.
And also I was like, besides the performance part, I was really into like the music industry.
Yes.
I was into like artist management, relationship management. I was into like brand partnerships. I was the guy making the tour posters and booking the venues and booking the sound people and arranging all the transport, like not for that band on that scale, but in all the bands before that. Like I was really like the hands-on kind of like really into it. Like I like that stuff. And so I think I had just enough success really to be dangerous, where it was like, yeah, I've met these people and I know these people and I can make this work. And then we had a couple of people still at university, and they put their studies on hold that year to like be available for this tour.
So the build up, you were very much, the expectation was like, it's all been leading up to 2012. 2012 was where we're going to...
Yeah, we're going to do it.
We're going to do it.
We're going to do it.
Okay, so that's the kind of expectation, the excitement.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And it hadn't been like smooth sailing the whole way. Like you figure stuff out. And I don't think that any of it, like in hindsight, I don't think any of it was malicious. I think some people maybe weren't quite like prepared for kind of what that whole thing entails. Like being in a band is hard, and being a touring musician is hard. And it does take effort and work, and you do need luck and a tailwind to kind of blow you along to a certain extent. And then we finished this tour and we kind of decided we were going to like take a couple of weeks and then we'll talk about the year ahead and what we can do. And then I got an email from this guy, and the subject line was poos.
Is this to your I Am Dribble?
No, so we'd upgraded at this point. It's something a little more serious on the email front. But it was to everyone in the band. Thanks very much. I've decided to take a break. I'll let you know what happens.
From who?
The singer of the band.
Okay.
And that was it.
And that was it, full stop.
And that was it.
And what? And then, where did he go?
So then he kind of went to ground, and I had just finished university. So while I was at university, I was doing the songwriting degree during the day, and in the evenings, I'd be flying to Australia and playing gigs or like touring in the holidays and things like that. And then, so for me, it was like this amazing part-time job where I was like studying this thing and I was living it, and I felt like I'd earned it. I felt like I deserved this. I felt like I was passionate enough about it to like forego sensible decisions and like thrust myself forward, and that this was my reward for that. And I was good and I put the time in, and then it just kind of disappeared like sand through your fingers.
So this is bizarre. So surely you had like a schedule planned, contract signed, commitments to fulfill. How can a guy just basically fuck off and leave?
I think, well, the thing
or
is
did that, he go and...
So I think the thing is that all of the contracts were in his name, so ultimately it's his right. decision.
Oh, good.
And so what I'm grateful for is that, like, a couple of people in the band had put their university studies on hold for that year to do the band, and the band wasn't there. And we're talking, like, it's February. It's the start of the year. It's not like, you know, we're halfway through the year and this happens. It's like, okay, we're starting the year and now it's like falling over. And so for them, it was like, well, now what do they do? And for me, what do I do? So I
But
was,
you at least had the uni thing to I'd fall
finished.
Back on.
Well, I finished.
Oh, you'd finished.
So
okay.
I graduated.
Okay.
So I graduated and I was like caught in this thing where I was like, is this band coming back? Do I need to be available for this? Is this really on the edge of like becoming a full-time thing? And it was really tangible and it really could have.
Yeah.
And that could be my career and this is what I've been going for. Or I could never hear from this guy again.
And the latter. That's
and,
what happened.
And months went by. And so this thing of like, well, do you go out and get a different job?
Yeah.
And at that point, I had a music degree. What kind of job can you get? And so lots of people were back at university yeah. doing like a teacher's diploma. And I had decided that I definitely didn't want to do teaching at that point, having dipped my toe into that world a little bit earlier. And so I didn't really know what to do. And I kind of my answer to that was to do nothing.
Well, I can kind of imagine because the success came like relatively early and by the sounds of it, it wasn't like you were gigging for hours every single day. You know, like the classic Ed Sheeran story or like the Beatles in Hamburg, just like hours and hours and hours and then kind of got picked up. You were kind of doing it part time, but then got like mainstream, let's say. It could probably, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it can probably almost like condition you to think, well, this is quite easy. I don't need to do much in order to get a big amount of success.
Yeah, I think we were at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
In terms of like catching the winds of success. And like luck is a big part of music, right? Like it 100% is. There's millions of people. I think something like 120,000 songs go up. Maybe that number's way too small. 120,000 songs a day on Spotify, like
yes.
being added. You know, just like there's an infinite number of people wanting to make music.
There's something like, I read it the other day and I'm going to fuck the statistic, but there's a not insignificant amount of songs on Spotify with literally zero plays.
Yeah.
And this podcast probably
yeah, having and they've had an interesting move now because if you had 10 plays, they'd pay you for 10 plays. And now they've cut the threshold to getting paid at 1,000 plays.
Oh, no chance for me.
Either. Well, exactly. So how many people out there are in indie bands putting things out on Spotify? And yeah. you don't ever put money on Spotify to get paid.
Yeah, of course.
Because they're infamous for not paying. In yeah. fact, you have to pay money to get it there. So actually yeah. you're starting from zero. So most people would never even recoup the 10 quid it costs to put a song on Spotify or yeah. to whichever distributor does that. Yeah.
So going back to that story, so that's an interesting thing or an interesting point. And I suppose from a... dare I say, mental health, wider outlook on life thing, what I can imagine is that you have had this relative level of success. Success is obviously all subjective, but a relative level of success. And it wasn't like there was a kind of downward trajectory and you fell out of love with it. It kind of off a cliff edge. And then suddenly, that, I mean, that must have been... like without being like, oh, poor me, blah, blah, blah. But when you have something that you're really aiming towards and that's like your whole life goal and purpose and you see a real future with it, suddenly taken away, that must have been fucked.
Yeah, it was pretty full on. It was...
So what, yeah, and I suppose on that, and then how did you deal with it? How was it? How did you deal with it? And what was the kind of next steps after that, I guess?
Yeah, it was. And it was one of those things where it was like the band or the project had... success and there was money flying around, but being the five people in the band that didn't write the song and didn't record the record, like there's nothing to fall back on there. Like it's not your name on the contract. It might be you doing press interviews, and we used to sign t-shirts for an hour a night after every gig, and we used to have our faces on the posters.
Get your pen.
But at the end of the day, like it's someone else's song and someone else's rewards for yeah. that, right? So he could go to ground and do whatever he wanted to do. And we'd been playing for him essentially for free for 2 years because the idea was, well, when it gets good for us, it'll get good for you. is kind of the thing. And we'd said, well, let's talk about contracts. We don't do contracts. Okay, well, there's a lesson learned there.
We don't.
And then this thing of like, well, okay, so we negotiated a percentage of the gigs that we'd play because, you know, like this high profile band was playing these gigs. And it's like, sure, you might get a gig where the band will get paid 10 grand and you might take home a few hundred dollars of that. But you'd also be doing 3 weeks on the road playing to pubs, half empty pubs in Australia to no one for $5 a ticket and making no money. So the band, congratulations, we just did 3 weeks of successful touring. The band made $0. So your percentage of $0 is $0. So I finished university, this whole band thing, just when it felt like it was going somewhere, like sustainable, kind of like the floor kind of falls away from you. And so I was really conflicted. And I think part of it is like the sense of identity. It's like I'd grown up being the music guy and this was my thing. And I don't think I was used to that degree of success because it happened so quickly, but it was fun. Like it was an exciting ride to then be met with like, okay, well, the real world's here and you've got to go and do something. So I was married at the time and my wife had a job working for like a marketing agency. And so I'd get up in the morning and drive her to work. And then I would sit at home and wait for the phone to call for the next band thing until like 5 o'clock. And then
how long was this period?
And then you'd go and pick her up and then have your evening. And that went on for like 6 months. And when you're 22, 23, recently married, and you feel like you should be like contributing to your house.
Yeah.
And looking after the people in your life and an exciting time in your career. And I just spent way too much time by myself in a room doing nothing because I didn't know which way to go. If I got a job, I couldn't do the band if it came back. And the band could come back at any second. Or another band could come along, or, you know, any kind of creative endeavor that way. And so I just kind of felt like option paralysis. And equally, I kind of fell out of love with it to the point where I was like, I can't believe I spent that many hours over this many years over my entire life doing this like crazy nebulous music thing in the hopes that that would somehow return to me a fulfilling career. I was like, if I'd spent that much time and effort and energy and money into playing golf, I would have had a better chance of getting paid as a golf player than I would have as a musician. Pretty much almost anything you could have done, I could have spent that much time. The only thing I think, I don't know, having been to music school, like music school is hard. Getting a career out of music is hard. Going to acting school, acting students, that's hard. Dance students, that's really hard. I was always like, thank God I didn't want to be a dancer because how do those people how do those people pay their rent? I have absolutely no idea. And so I just spent all the time by myself and I didn't know what to do. I tried reading some books and I just like,
how are you feeling? What was your headspace like?
At the start I was optimistic. That was like summer in New Zealand. So February, just had this big, beautiful summer. And then I just kind of like slipped down the spiral really quickly and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And I didn't know what to do. And even like that thing of being like, okay, I've finished my schooling, I'm going to start a career and I'm out of university. That's hard for anyone. Yeah. Like I wouldn't go back to that time in my life for all the money in the world. Mm. And like, whether you've done a music degree or not, whether you've got a really strong sense of what you want to do with your life or you don't career wise, that gap from like, I'm out of high school, what do I do next?
Yeah.
A course, university, work, whatever, into like a long-term career. That transition's really hard. And I was really bad at it and I didn't know what to do. So I just did nothing. And then too much time by yourself is not, does not make a happy boy. And so I started off, you know, I got depressed. I was depressed and that led to like anxiety, and anxiety was building about the future and about, I was depressed about the situation I was in. I was anxious about the future and what that would look like. And then that kind of spiraled into like panic attacks to the point where like I couldn't even actually like do a job if I had gone and got one, because like I was so emotionally on edge that I would just like break down into tears and like any little thing would trigger me. And I just got worse and worse and worse. And in the end, my wife at the time threw her job in because she had to look after me. And we gave up our apartment we were living in and we moved back in with her parents so that her parents could like support us, and her family was amazing. And I ran into a family friend at the supermarket one day, and I was just, you know, I had gone to do a couple of things, and she was a nurse, and I've known her my whole life. She's one of my friend's mums, and she's amazing. And she looked at me and just said, "You're not doing okay, are you?" And I was just like, "No, I'm really not. I'm not doing okay." And so she prompted me to book in with a GP, and I went and saw a doctor. And they give you this piece of paper for like a mental health assessment. And it's like, here's a bunch of multi-choice questions, or like rank yourself between like 0 and 5 on these things. Have you ever thought about this? How do you feel about the future? Do you have trouble sleeping? Do you eat too much? All this sort of thing. And I remember filling in this form and giving it back to him, and I'd scored a perfect test. As in like,
yeah.
As in like, that's not what you want.
Yeah.
And so he's like, well, I think you should look at going on like some antidepressant medication. And so I called up my parents and I talked to them, and you know, there's this like thing where it's like, oh, someone's sad and they're unhappy, so we should put them on antidepressants. And this idea that like antidepressants are massively overprescribed, and if you look at statistics of people, a huge number of people are on antidepressants, and maybe not all of those people should be on that, but it kind of seems to be like the first tool that we reach for. Mm. So my parents, or my family and my support network, also still being like tied to the church, were like, oh, well, maybe before you go on medication, have you tried this or this, or we'll pray for you. Or they had a friend who was this amazing woman, and they were very generous, and she was very generous, and she's incredibly well-educated, and she was like a professional psychiatrist. And her solution was, before you go on medication off the shelf, let's get your like vitamin C levels through the roof. Let's get your magnesium levels through the roof. Let's give you this like massive drawer of like pharmaceutical grade vitamins and some exercise and some lifestyle changes to try and like build you up again.
Yeah.
Before we kind of go for this thing. Because antidepressants can come with side effects, and whether or not that's the right thing. So I was like waking up in hysterics at like 8 in the morning. I used to keep a can of Coke by my bedside table. So the first thing I did as soon as I was conscious was skull that to get some like sugar and caffeine in my system, because I needed like a little bit of a boost, because otherwise the morning was bad. Mm. And then I'd take this like concoction of like home remedy, pharmaceutical grade vitamin C with magnesium and all these other things. And it was like horrible stuff to drink. And you just had to like chow it down. And they're like, yeah, you might see some benefit in 6 to 8 weeks. Mm. And I'm like, I can't, like, I'm not in a good place here.
It's hard
like,
to get day like, to day, right?
I can't do half an hour,
yeah,
let alone 6 weeks. Mm. And even if I could, and in 6 weeks I felt better, that's not going to solve the problem of, like, am I in this band, am I not in this band? Am I pursuing music, am I not pursuing music? Am I looking down the barrel of a lifetime of, like, oh, you kind of had all the tools you needed, and you kind of, like, dropped the ball? What I ended up doing was, like, I was clearly not very well, to the point that, like, I wasn't sleeping, I wasn't eating, I lost something like 28% of my body weight in, like, 6 months. My hair turned to straw. Like, you can't see me on this, but I'm, like, graying in my late 20s, and now I'm 35 and half my hair's gray.
That's a good look, silver fox.
Thank you. I got so dehydrated, I couldn't use a toilet properly anymore. I was in hysterics constantly exhausted, emotionally exhausted, physically exhausted. Couldn't watch TV, couldn't contribute anything.
Just everything would trigger.
Yeah, just like that. Just like any random thought, and it was like just, you're always at like redlining at like 99, and it's just that like extra thought push you over the edge. And then that could take half an hour to calm down from, and then just like again and again and again. And it was exhausting. And the physical side of it as well, like you can feel the adrenaline, just like, like my legs would go numb and constantly, just like days and days and days. And in the end, they were like, this isn't, you know, this like gently, let's restore these balance levels of chemicals using like alternative therapies or however you want to call it. I mean, it's scientifically backed stuff, but it was like definitely like gentle intervention isn't working. And so my parents-in-law at the time called up another family friend who was also in the church, who was a doctor, and said, look, can you see him? Like, he's falling apart. Like, I must have been horrible to live with, and like, hats off to them. They were incredible to me and always have been. And they drove me to this guy, and he had a history of mental health issues himself. He looked at me in the eye while holding me down on a hospital bed and said, "It gets better than this." And then he injected me with some like anti-anxiety medication, which I actually had like a mild allergic reaction to. So kick in the teeth, right? So like it felt like someone injecting napalm in my arm, and like you could feel it as it was kind of like moving through your body. It was like really horrible. But within like 20 minutes, I felt amazing. Mm-hmm. And I was just like brought back on the level. And then I saw a different psychiatrist who prescribed me like, I don't know, proper medication and like, yeah, brackets there, but like Prozac and Valium essentially. So like, up until that point, I had seen 4 GPs, 3 different counselors, a social psychologist, 2 psychiatrists, and like a couple of other people who would just like throw in their 2 cents, you know, into like trying to figure out like, I used to be able
well,
to...
Well, that probably also added massive degree of anxiety, all the different opinions.
Totally. And
quite overwhelming.
And when I remember going to the social psychologist and being like, am I going to go home after this appointment, or am I going to be like sent to like an inpatient thing? Like, did the dudes in white coats come out because you have crossed the line of being safe or whatever? And that never happened. But what I would do is traditional medication saved my life.
Yeah.
And it did. And I was on Valium for a little bit, and that was awful, and it would make me like wet the bed because it would like knock me out too much, so like that wasn't going to be a long-term solution. And traditional antidepressants can take, you know, a couple of months to kick in. So I'd wake up in the morning, I'd smash this can of Coke, I'd smash some like lorazepam, and then just like calm down. And then throughout the day, I kind of like managed that. And then gradually over a few weeks, the panic attack subsided. The general level of anxiety came down. The general level of like depression lifted. And suddenly you start to feel like yourself again. And then it feels like, okay, well, I can do something with this. It's like I'm down, but I'm not out, right?
Yes.
And
there's a foundation there now.
100%. And I think the thing for me was that I was always worried that like, even if I got better, hypothetically, because I didn't believe I would, when you're in it, you know, you're like, this is me now, I don't know what's happened, but this is my
how long life. Was this period
kind of like 7 or 8 months
okay
in total, and in hindsight I'd probably not been that well
in the lead up to
that as well.
And then actually are you still on medication?
Yeah, I've been on medication the entire since time then. The entire time you've known me. So I went on that medication when I was 23. Started at 23. I was on it for a couple of years, and then I went off it for a few years, and that was fine, and I was like totally cool. And then one of my friends committed suicide, and that was at a very intense time career-wise for me, and it kind of relapsed into some of that anxiety and panic stuff. And so I went back on the medication for then. And then after about a year, I went off it again for a couple of years. And then I moved to London. And that was probably not the smartest idea to do that transition, not with medication support. And so then I moved to London. And that was very intense. And we've talked about some of those experiences somewhere else. And so I went back on the medication then. And I've pretty much been on it ever since.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? Because from just in terms of people listening to this who know you but don't know that side, obviously, you'd never think it. You're such a friendly, chatty, and also like calm and competent guy, because obviously we know each other through work. We used to work together. Creative producer is a very stressful job. But you always had things under control. You'd never think there was this backstory of anxiety and depression, and to that extent. Do you look back at the music times, not from the kind of teenager, but I suppose when you were known, let's say, with how do you look back on it? Is it with pride? Is it with regret? Is it with, that's a shame that didn't go? So what's the kind of feeling, how you reflect on it?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. What I say to people is, I'm really glad that it happened, and I'm really glad that it's not happening now. Mm. So like, I felt like I got enough of a taste of what that life would be like, the good and the bad, to the point that actually I'm okay without that, and that I can be successful in my life and creative in my life, and we can talk about that as well, in ways that doesn't mean chasing pop hits on the radio. And that's cool.
Because your motivation at the time, was it, do you think it was for those more extrinsic things? Maybe not the money, because I know you said that there was challenges with that, but like the fame, the recognition, or were you doing it more for the love of doing it? And of course, I'm sure there was like a bit of a mix, but
It was a mixed bag. For me, I wanted to prove people wrong because people said, you can't do this. There you go. Think of the 1% of musicians.
Such a powerful feeling, motivator.
Yeah. I wanted to be like, I agree with you. Music is hard. You can't make a career in music. And for most people, you can't. But for me, I'm going to show you that.
Yeah.
And I believed I was talented enough, and I believed that I had the social skills and the music skills, because it is a social game. It's like teamwork, and it's like creative personalities, and then you've got the financial side and the business side. And what makes me good about my job now as a creative producer in media and advertising or in the brand world is I have one foot in creative.
Yes.
I'm a songwriter.
Yeah.
And I have one foot in business world.
Yes.
Which is the numbers have to work.
Yes.
The timings have to work. And if I was not good at both of those, I would have been terrible in the band, and I'd be terrible at what I do now.
How do you think you developed that self-belief? Because I think there's a difference between confidence and genuine self-belief, belief in your own ability. Like, at such a young age, do you think that was just an ingrained part of your personality to think like, no, I'm good enough to do this? Or do you think it was through reps and getting the hours in for your teenage years? Because basically I'm someone who just naturally have like, a degree of external facing confidence, but like really limited self-belief, genuine belief in my abilities. And it's not until I actually do something enough times that I get like evidence of the fact that, okay, all right, I'm at least semi-competent in doing that thing. Like, I need like the proof before I can have any degree of self-belief. How does it work with you? Was that more like ingrained?
I think I had just enough success to be dangerous. So like, just enough moments of being like, yeah, this is great. Or people coming up to me like, yeah, I really enjoyed that. At the key moments where you go, okay, I'll take another step towards that. And then you take another step and then something else happens that kind of reaffirms that position.
Yeah.
And so I kind of was like, it's not that I was led down a path, but I had enough encouragement that what I was doing was seeing the results that I wanted to take the next step.
Right, yeah.
And so it's not that you go from like 0 to 100 in one go. It's like you go 0 to 1 and then 1 to 2.
It's not like you had this deluded self-belief. You had people encouraging you.
I probably did. I think I probably was deluded with self-belief.
Okay.
Because there is the fundamental grounding that like music careers are hard, but some people make it work.
Yeah.
And my thing for me is that I was never the singer in the band, because I used to be a reasonably good singer when I was a child, and then I hit puberty and I couldn't sing at all. Like, my sense of tone and grounding was completely out the window. And so I loved writing songs, and I loved other people singing my songs, and I happened to have people in my life at that time who were good singers, and I could support them. And so we would co-write songs together, and we'd co-arrange things together, and I would perform them and would record them, and we would be hustling people for opportunities and like seeing rewards of that. But I couldn't stand on a stage by myself at that time with a guitar and sing you a song that I'd written.
Yeah.
So I was kind of relying on the teamwork to get me where I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And so when the Avalanche City thing came along, and here's a guy who's got a repertoire that he's written, but he needs help making that live, I lapped that up and I slid right into that.
Yes.
Where I've got to now with my music, and I think
karaoke nights on Thursdays.
Exactly. And I think through my music degree as well, it's like, I would rather perform my own material to 20 people.
Yes.
Than play Dave's music in front of 20,000.
Yeah.
which I've done and did. And that was great. And that was fun. But in terms of creative integrity and music as being a form of expression, and the more life you live and the more stories you have to tell, that became more important to me. So I have a band now that performs with me, and I perform my own songs, and I play occasionally, and I haven't played live in a couple of years, and I've been like building a recording studio in my house, and I'm working on a new record, and I'm kind of like reigniting some of that stuff in balance with a career rather than all the eggs in that kind of basket, which I don't know, it kind of feels in some ways like, I don't feel like I've given up, but I feel like I'm creating a life that I want to live, that I can live healthily, that provides for my family, is creatively rewarding for me, and actually scratches some of those itches that the music thing, like the teamwork and the collaboration and the like, pulling the middle finger to what your life should look like.
Yes. Well, it kind of feels like, especially from a music point of view, you're kind of now doing it predominantly, if not pretty much all, for the enjoyment of doing it, as opposed to chasing whatever fame or proving other people wrong. On that point, did you watch the Lewis Capaldi documentary on Netflix?
I haven't seen it, but I am familiar with his story.
Worth a watch. It's really interesting. obviously different levels, of course, but the same principle, right? He basically says that he preferred playing into half empty pubs, his own thing, as opposed to obviously then selling out Glastonbury stadiums across the world, because the pressure and the associations you have it with is so much different when you're just purely doing it for the love of it, and then when you're doing it to answer to partners, sponsors, producers, executives, etc.
So what happened from me being at home doing nothing and then getting on this medication and then like rebuilding my life at 23 was I got a phone call from a place I'd worked at uni where a friend of mine had done an internship. It was this event management company. And during university, when I wasn't touring, our friend would call us up occasionally and be like, we need someone to put on branded t-shirts and hand out balloons or like collect tickets or like pretend to be security for some like corporate event somewhere. And the company was the best in New Zealand they were like the top dogs. And so they called me and said, obviously you worked for us casually and we like you. And one of our juniors is having health problems, ironically, and can't come into work. Do you want their job? And at that point, I was so unwell. I missed the call. It was a voicemail. I didn't call them back. I was just like, no. That's just so far away from anything that I could do right now. A couple of weeks go by. I get on this medication. I calm down. I start kind of like recentering myself. And start feeling like I'm kind of like pulling things back together. And they call me back. And this is like the top event agency in the country where people go and do event management degrees. And there's like hundreds of graduates fighting over this like three jobs. And they call me back, having not even answered their first phone call, and said, yeah, that person's still off. And the job's still yours if you want it. And so I called them back straight away. I was like, yeah, I'll be there tomorrow. And so I would wake up, smash my can of Coke, smash my drugs.
Do you still do? Is that still your
home? No, 100% not. I'd smash my drink, I'd smash my drugs, I'd smash some breakfast. My father-in-law would drive me into town on his way to work. I would be in tears, just like, holy crap, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. Still piecing myself back together. Jump out the car, wipe my tears off, go do a day at work, pretend to be okay. Every 2 hours, having a top up on the meds.
Fucking hell, yeah.
And then get picked up at like 5:30 on his way home. Burst into tears in the car. Go home, have dinner, more drugs, straight to sleep. And that was it for like a couple of months.
That is maybe not to that level, but that is probably so much more common than we think. Even metaphorically, just like having to just put a face on, work, back, exhausted.
Yeah, fucked. They asked me to come in for 6 weeks, and I was there for 9 months. And in that time, I got back into the routine. I was making money. I was a minimum wage, but I was making money. I was contributing to teams. They had an in-house creative team who were making videos for these events and branding for events. And their creative director was really open, and he valued my input. And I got to contribute creatively to these things where it was like,
yeah,
these projects are like, the clients are big brands. They have big budgets.
Yeah.
It's not music where you're trying to like scrap something on pennies and dimes. It's like, yeah, you can make this whatever you want it to be as long as it's great. And I fell in love with that idea of like, well, how can we take that creativity and the teamwork and the music, the bits about music that you love, and channel it through this other expression in a way that's like really rewarding?
I love that. So that's basically the step up that you needed upon which to rebuild your life. Just conscious that this is going to stop recording in 2 minutes. Let's finish with three quick fire things that you do now in your life to stop you going back onto that spiral. What are your three non-negotiables that you need to do consistently to prevent slipping back into those feelings?
It's a really good question. And number one is I take my medication every day. And for me, that's non-negotiable.
Yep.
And for me, that's okay. And if I'm on those pills for the rest of my life, then I can handle that. I might not be. I could come off them in a year or in 2 years, or if I decided, or between my doctor and I decided that was a good thing to do. But I'm also at peace with the fact that if that's what I need, then that's cool.
Number two
is connections and friendships and relationships. So I've got a really great partner who supports me, and we can talk about things, and I've got friends that know my story and they look out for me, and my family is part of that as well. And I think part of the reason I went down that slippery slope so quickly was the isolation of being cut off. Whether you cut yourself off or you know, too much time by yourself is not going to be good. Yeah. And so
I think a lot of people felt that during COVID.
100%. And there is
a reason that the worst prison sentence that you get,
solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And during COVID, I was super aware of that.
Yeah.
I was like, am I going to unravel? Is this going back to that? And I was okay. I was on my medication. I kept connections with people virtually and at work, and I took care of myself. And then the third thing is having a creative outlet. So for me, I still do music. I still have a way of expressing myself. I have a job that involves some creativity. So I feel like I'm still living that life in some way. I don't feel like this is the old me and this is the new me. I feel like all of those things that I love, I am still connected to. And whether that's songwriting or doing a branding project or work or for other people, that might be whatever creative expression that is. Drawing, I'm a terrible drawer, but if you're into drawing, that's cool. If you're into writing, then that's cool. But reading even, but having some sort of creative outlet for me, I think helps.
Johnny Brock, thank you very much for coming on. Your honesty, unbelievably interesting and helpful, I hope, to listen to. You're a great man. You're fantastic to work with. It was only a couple of months towards the end of my time, but we had a bloody good time. So thank you very much. Let's go get one of those full-fat Cokes and one of those concoctions. I'm in.
Let's do it. Thank you, Howie.
Cheers, buddy. Thank you very much.